Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. This week, I'm recycling a good installment on corporations, originally broadcast in August 2008. This was shortly before the economic collapse of the Western Hemisphere, brought about by our giant financial corporations. And it was before the Supreme Court declared in Citizens United that corporations are citizens with the same right to buy elections as everyone else. So those two particular points don't get mentioned. What does get mentioned is still entirely relevant. Besides my own, the show features the voice of business historian Ted Nace, plus performers Utah Phillips, James McMurtry, and Roy Zimmerman. I hope you'll stay tuned.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the multinational corporations and to the profit for which they stand, one interlocking directorate under no government, indivisible, with monopoly and cheap labor for all.
Today we'll look at America's most dangerous enemy. No, not Iran, silly. I mean the big corporations. I think that by now, transnational corporations have finally moved into first place as the most powerful institutions on planet Earth, leaving the nation-state, the church, and even Skull and Bones far behind. Our conclusion may not be news to you. Our conclusion is we've got to drive a stake through this institution where its heart would be if it had one. But you might enjoy some of the new examples. We'll hear a great talk by activist and business historian Ted Nace on how corporations changed from mistrusted, tightly controlled entities designed to serve the public to the modern incarnation of Satan himself. So touch not that dial, and away we go. When did you first notice that corporations had gotten much bigger, even greedier, totally out of control, and ubiquitous? Was it when you walked through the center of your town and noticed that all the mom-and-pop stores were gone? Maybe you remember when you were a kid and your father took you into the city to see a ball game. The Phillies at Connie Mack Stadium. Connie Mack, a figure from real local history, folk history. Not even a Philly, but legendary manager of the Philadelphia Athletics. Connie Mack Stadium is gone. Afterwards, to see the Phillies, you went to Veterans Stadium, then to Citizens Bank Park. Except you didn't go to Citizens Bank Park because after they put in all the expensive skyboxes for the super-rich corporate fat cats and sold all the season tickets to the merely affluent corporate fat cats, there aren't many seats available general admission for proletarian slobs like you and your kid. Connie Mack Stadium, Forbes Field, Candlestick Park, Mile High Stadium, Tiger Stadium, Astrodome, them was the days. Now modernized to Citizens Bank Park, PNC Park, AT&T Park, Coors Field, Comerica Park, and Minute Maid Park, respectively. Imagine a World Series played in the venues Minute Maid Park and Tropicana Field. The Battle of the Fruits. It's a natural. Or was it when you noticed that all of a sudden, everybody's underwear had brand names embroidered on the outside of the waistband? And young people wearing their jeans low, so everybody can read that waistband and admire their impeccable taste in foundation garments. Advertising on underwear, what a stroke of marketing genius! And once the corporations own all the means of production, what do? Shut them down. Outsource them. And the next thing you know, your world looks like this.
Sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. Piled up on the loading dock, they're just gonna sit there till they rot, cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. The empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. Man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. Thank you. we got. And if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Let's take a listen to Ted Nace describing how corporations changed from tightly regulated, temporary entities required to serve the public to, masters of the universe. Thomas Jefferson worried that if corporations weren't tightly controlled by the state, you'd end up with a business elite running the country and a staggeringly unequal distribution of wealth. Hey, not a bad job, as prognostications go. We should understand the 18th century as well as he understands the 21st. Anyway, Nace is the author of Gangs of America, The Rise of Corporate Power and the Disabling of Democracy. This book is available from his publisher or as a free PDF download on the internet. In either case, browse over to www.gangsofamerica.com. www.gangsofamerica.com. Here's Nace in conversation with Sue Supriano from her show, Stepping Out of Babylon.
Well, 13 years later, when they sat down in Philadelphia to draft a constitution, the question of corporate power was debated among the delegates. They made a distinction in those days that's a useful one that we've really stopped making. They wanted business, and they wanted business to be successful, but they didn't want business to run the country. And in order to keep business from running the country, from being the sort of the tail that wags the dog, they decided the best way to do that was to put corporations under the control of the body of the legislative body that was closest to the grassroots. So in those days, that would have been the state legislatures. So they voted against and they voted down Franklin and Madison's scheme to put corporate power into the U.S. Constitution. They kept control over corporations at the state level. And the individual states then set up systems for chartering corporations, the charter being the document that empowers a corporation. And those charters, well into the 1800s, even after the Civil War, were really a very different kind of document than what we see in a corporate charter today. I mean, we don't think much about corporate charters today because a corporate charter basically says, you have the authority to go out there and do whatever you want. But in those days, a corporation was specifically required to state a public purpose. A corporation was not given an indefinite lifespan. It was required to come back to the state legislature every 20 or 30 years, or in the case of banks, every 7 years, and renew that compact, that agreement with the public. Corporations were required to have their legal location in the same place as their physical activities. Now, those kinds of requirements are subtle, but they're effective. And it was the breaking of some of those strictures that caused corporations really to spin out of control in the late 1800s, particularly this requirement that a corporation's physical location and its legal location be one and the same. In addition, corporations were denied the kind of rights that now corporations have developed. So all these things were quite different before the Civil War. And it's that history of successful control of corporate power and then the history of how that control was lost. That's not a history we get taught in our schools.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of an aristocracy isn't something that we really have in our language anymore. We don't run around and talk about aristocrats. But people like Jefferson and Alex de Tocqueville, who was the French gentleman who witnessed and documented the birth of the early days of American democracy, they very much had in mind the idea that in America we were trying to leave that class-based system of wealth and power behind. And they also drew a direct connection between aristocracy and corporate power. Now remember, business does not equate to a corporation. A corporation is a particular way of organizing business where the state grants particular privileges to private business. Now, before the Civil War, that was thought to be an exchange. Those particular benefits were considered a fair exchange for some kind of benefit from the corporation back to society. Well, once that was lost, and corporations had the power to basically get the privileges without giving back, they had a whole different mindset. Now let's just go back to something Jefferson said. In 1816 he said, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations." And de Tocqueville said almost very similar words. He said in 1830, "The friends of democracy should keep their eyes anxiously fixed on an industrial aristocracy, for if ever again permanent inequality of conditions and aristocracy make their way into the world, it will have been by that door that they entered." He had his eyes on a sort of backdoor re-entry of aristocracy into America. Well, flash forward to the year 2000. I'm just looking at an article in the New York Times from September 25th, 2003 by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. They took a look at the incomes of Americans and what had happened to those incomes just since 1979. In the last 20 years, the wealth and income of the top 1% of Americans has basically tripled. The average after-tax income of that top 1% in 1979 was $286,000. By 2000, it had gone up to $862,000. So the top 1% had managed to triple their share. Meanwhile, the middle 20% was at about $40,000 both 20 years ago and today, and the lowest 20% was at about $20,000 after taxes. So what we see is this top group stretching out their lead more and more. And of course, there isn't someone with a box full of money who hands it out, you know, to people. This is all done through a system of laws. This is done through an economic system. So if we really want to understand how our country has slipped back into this system of such a great divide in wealth, you know, in this country, if the wealth were divided equally, the income of each family of four would be $130,000 a year. This isn't a rich country. It's a very rich country. But understanding what happened between the time when Jefferson made those warnings and then the situation we've ended up with today, that's the kind of history we really haven't gotten, and that's the kind of history which I and other people are trying to fill in.
Okay.
Right. The general number has gotten to be about 500 to 1, the salary of the average CEO as a multiple of the salary of the average worker in a company. You know, this isn't something that is a mystery to most Americans. You know, there's the saying, nothing is illegal if 100 businessmen decide to do it. It's not that we're unaware as a society that this is going on. And in fact, that left-wing publication, Business Week, was curious. After the Seattle protests, they wanted to know, and the business community basically wanted to know, were those protests sort of an aberrant expression of a fringe in society, or was it sort of the tip of the iceberg of a greater dissatisfaction? They hired the Harris Polling Organization to ask the American people what they thought about corporate power, and the answers were really pretty shocking. They asked the question, do you think business has too much power over too many aspects of our lives? 82% of Americans agreed with that statement. So that's really a cross-section that even includes Democrats and Republicans. Now, you know, one part of corporate power is a whole series of Supreme Court decisions that have sort of built up what people call the corporate Bill of Rights. Although corporations don't appear in the original Constitution, corporations can now run to the courts and overturn laws on the basis that those laws are violating their rights. That's just an example of how this happens. In September, there was a law passed at the federal level called the Do Not Call list. This is an idea that there ought to be a way for people to put themselves on a list that would allow them to prevent telemarketing companies from calling them at home. It was a very popular idea. 52 million people had gotten themselves signed onto the list by the end of September. You know, that's a lot of people. That's 2 million more people than voted for Al Gore, and 2,400,000 more than voted for George Bush. So that's more people than it takes to elect a president in this country. And when that many people are walking in the same direction, both the Republicans and the Democrats are going to listen. Both parties supported this legislation. It went through the Senate 95-0. It went through the House of Representatives 412-8. And it went through both the Senate and the House in a single day. Well, when a piece of legislation flies through the Senate and the House, that's power. And you can make that happen. That's the power of 52 million people. Well, we now have a measurement of corporate power, because that law passed Senate and House on a Thursday. On Monday morning, it was signed into law by President Bush. Within minutes, it had been declared unconstitutional by Federal District Court Judge Edward Nottingham on the basis that it violated the corporation's right to free speech. In other words, their right to call you on the phone was interpreted as a basic constitutional right. Not only that they had that right, but that right would trump the individual family's privacy right to turn the phone off as they saw fit. Well, that kind of intrusion into private spaces, I believe, even more than some of these socioeconomic statistics, are the types of things that are beginning to ignite, if not a populist revolt, at least the desire for one. I think there's more sentiment than action, but because of that underlying sentiment, there's really a lot of potential here. There's a lot of kindling waiting to be lit. There's a lot of people who are very, very angry. They just don't know what to do about it. Well, you know, I talk in colleges and also in high schools, and I think what people forget is really how interested young people are in stories that really mean something. They like conflict. They like to learn about power. A lot of this is some pretty bloody history and some fascinating history. I mean, the fact that 3,000 women and children were killed on tobacco plantations in Virginia is not exactly a pretty story. But it's a lot more interesting, those kinds of conflicts, those kinds of things that happen to people's real lives, and often the struggles that allowed people to win against larger powers. We need so much more of that to make our young people feel like they really have a stake in the future. They need examples not just of overwhelming power, but also examples of how people have beaten large corporations. Many examples of that can be found in American history. This is not just a story of the people, organized people, losing and losing and losing against organized money. It's really a series of battles between organized money versus organized people. Sometimes organized money wins, sometimes organized people win. 1937, the Supreme Court for 50 years had clung to a doctrine called substantive due process, which was the most ludicrous contraption of legal theories, basically supporting the right of corporations to enter into contracts with their employees, employment contracts, no matter how unequal, on the theory that this was a fundamental liberty of human beings. Well, the practical implication was that every time Congress passed a minimum wage law or a law setting a maximum work week, that the Supreme Court would declare those unconstitutional. Well, it turned out that World War I veterans marched on Washington. They set up a giant tent city in scenes very similar to what we've seen in the news from Seattle and many other anti-globalization protests. Those protests were aimed at the powers that be in Washington, and they said, we're not going to leave until we have our demands met. This was the first time that tanks rolled in the streets of Washington. Eisenhower at that time was a military officer. He routed the tent city that had been set up. The veterans were sent fleeing, the tent city was burned. But that demonstration of people taking action made it an impression on the Supreme Court. And in his memoirs, Judge Roberts, who became the deciding vote overturning that strange doctrine of substantive due process, said it was people power that had made the difference. He was concerned that if the Supreme Court didn't change and allow the New Deal to go forward, that the system eventually would crack. So the system accommodated And the doctrine of substantive due process was thrown out. The New Deal went forward, minimum wages, 40-hour work week, the weekend. All these things didn't just fall into our laps. They came about because of citizen struggles.
And we end on an optimistic note. As Ted Nace notes, if there's a solution, it'll be in the form of people power. Back in June, we had an installment of New World Notes with that title, People Power. And remember, media critic Eric Kleinberg was talking about how occasionally the people can join together and overcome bad rulings and bad decisions involving our communication systems. He painted this wonderful image of Code Pink and the NRA and many other grassroots organizations joining together and managing to overturn some particularly obnoxious FCC regulation. People power, too, I think, will bring about the demise of corporate rule, if anything does. And certainly there's enough people in this country who have had more than enough of it, including many, many, many employees of the corporations themselves. So be careful who you define as your enemy. The guy with the white collar may be just as fed up with it all as you are. In any case, thanks for listening. Thanks especially to Sue Supriano and Stepping Out of Babylon for the Ted Nace interview, which I have excerpted, edited, and otherwise wrought my will upon. New World Notes is produced at WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter, the station management staff, or the licensee, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your comments and suggestions are most welcome. Write to Kenneth Doust, New World Notes, WWUH-FM, University of Hartford, 200 Bloomfield Avenue, West Hartford, Connecticut, 06117. Or email me at kdoust, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. Until next time, from the spacious underground studios of WWUH, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.
I pledge allegiance to the flags of Microsoft and Exxon, and to whichever mega bank AT&T writes checks on. I swell with patriotic pride whene'er I hear them spell MULTINATIONAL. The sovereign nations of this world, we've canceled every one of them, and every race except the French, 'cause it's still fun to make fun of them. The wind is high, the market's bull. Guess that must be the smell of MULTINATION.